Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. It gives me great pleasure to invite Lynn Buchanan, the author of The Seventh Sense, The Secrets of Remote Viewing as Told by a Psychic Spy for the U.S. Military. He entered U.S. Army Intelligence in 1984 and for 8.5 years was trained to be a psychic spy. In the 1960s, the U.S. government became aware that Russia had a psychic spy unit that was very developed. And out of this came a tool and a training called controlled remote viewing, which allows a person to be able to, in a disciplined way, access any person, thing, event, information in time and space to be able to smell, taste, touch, and sense them, even to read their minds if necessary. But it's way more complex than that. We have invited today practically one of the ninjas of the controlled remote viewing industry. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Lynn Buchanan to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me.
I really appreciate you being here. This is such an exciting field, Lynn. There's a lot more excitement now than there ever was about controlled remote viewing and remote viewing in general. I'd like you to first establish a frame of reference for us about what it is and what it isn't from your perspective and experience.
Okay. The book, The Seventh Sense, says the psychic spy. Oh, that's in order to Hollywood it and sell it a little bit. The fact is that it's a science that was developed at Stanford Research Institute out in California in a research project, which was in response to the fact that they learned that Russia had basically psychic spies. But that didn't stir any imagination or anything. What stirred the imagination was a man named Pinkovsky, one of the workers on it, tried to defect, and when he did, he brought a bunch of the papers with him, and they found out that that's where our classified information was leaking. They had been looking for years for, for spies, ground spies, and moles and all this, and they found out that it was through that a lot of our top secret information was being found out by the Russians. So all of a sudden, they got pretty serious about it. As they got serious about it, of course, the Russians weren't going to tell us how to do things, and so they set up this research project at Stanford Research, and they started trying to find out what goes on in the mind of a psychic when they're actually doing real psychic work and doing it effectively. And the hope was that then they could train that those brainwave patterns into other people. Well, they found out that it's actually even much easier than that. But through the process of that research, they developed a methodology which is a science, actually, by which a person can emulate the effects and emulate the results of an extremely good natural psychic.
Bring the public into the distinction between being psychic and this controlled remote viewing protocol or series of protocols that allows a person to transcend time and space and to access information directly.
Well, that's an easy question with a very hard answer because
I know.
There are hundreds of differences. I think one of the main differences would be that as a controlled remote viewer, you don't go into any kind of a trance state. You sit there and you work through a set of procedures and protocols, much as though you were doing a chemistry experiment or something. And it doesn't take natural psychic talent. You don't have to be some kind of a swami or something. If you sit down and you go through these protocols and these steps, these steps are designed Along the line of, let's say, you know when you smile, you feel better?
Yes.
Okay. This is a physical discipline which is developed along the lines of a martial art, but also a martial art in which you physically talk to your subconscious mind, and your subconscious mind gives you physical cues in return. And those physical cues, through training, take on meaning, and that meaning can be given then to a customer who needs the information. A little example here. You know how a lie detector will tell if you're lying or telling the truth?
That's what I'm told.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But it can also tell if you're guessing.
I didn't know that.
Most people don't, because they don't want you to know that, because they want you to think, you know, that they're in charge of lying and telling the truth and all that. They don't want you guessing. But a tremendously good and well-trained polygrapher can look at those little squiggles, and he can tell whether you're guessing correctly or not, even though you don't know the answer. So somewhere in your subconscious mind, is that knowledge, that I guess you would say psychic knowledge. The trick is finding a way to get it to the conscious mind. And one of the facts of life is that the conscious and the subconscious just don't talk to each other.
Why do you think that is? I know you're going to explain how they interact, but why do you think that is?
I think it's probably some kind of a defense mechanism for us. The subconscious mind is awfully bright, awfully smart, and extremely fast, and many times extremely childish. And I think that, you know, if we were in constant contact with our subconscious mind directly, we might never grow up. Peter Pan, you know, for life. But the fact is that the subconscious mind can talk to the body. And the conscious mind can talk to the body. I can intentionally raise my arm, or let's say I'm not paying attention and something crawls across my hand. My hand will jump up before I'm even conscious of doing it. And so since the two can talk to each other, we train the body to be a translator between the conscious and subconscious mind. And we have found that it works extremely well as a translator. It can actually provide very highly detailed information. And when it does, you can ask a question to the conscious mind, pass that physically to the subconscious. The subconscious will come back with a physical reaction. And if you're trained enough, you look at the physical reaction and you know the answer.
Does this translate to us as the subconscious is connected in with everything that ever was in time space and everything that will be in time space almost?
Well, somehow, yes. Now, you know, people come by and they say, well, where does the information come from? And a lot of people want to say, well, it's spirit guides. And if they say it's spirit guides, I say, oh, well, thank you for that information. If they say it's holograms in the sky, then I say, oh, thank you for that information. And, you know, some say, well, it's the collective consciousness. And I say, oh, thank you. The fact is, nobody really knows where the information comes from. We just know that it comes into the subconscious mind at a very deep level, and that with training, you can bring that information up to the upper level, pass it to the body, and thereby to the conscious mind.
So, in a sense, there is a way to transcend space-time in the subconscious that can be trained to go out and gather data.
Piece of cake. No problem. Yes, absolutely yes. And in fact, you know, in things like dreams and all, your subconscious moves through time and space all the time anyway. And if you can take that inner child, get it to mature by giving it some responsibilities and let it grow up into an adult, then what's going to happen is it will learn to focus in on any one space and, you know, dot in space and time and give you detailed information about that one little dot. Or if you have a whole process, you want to know the entire process that caused something in history to happen, your subconscious can focus on that alone and give you the information for that.
So could it be said, Lynn, that there's really nothing in history that can't be known, the factual side of it?
Absolutely true. Now, that brings up another point about remote viewing, though, and any psychic work, in fact. We can know it, but, you know, the first caveman, okay, what was his name? Well, we can find that out, but there's no feedback. We can't prove it. And this is one of the things that psychics, remote viewers, and everyone faces, that you have knowledge that there is no proof of. And you look at history. You may find out something that's absolutely opposed to what's written in the history books. You know, the history books are written by the victors.
Yes.
And yet, and so there's no proof that you're right. And so we have to find a way to know how dependable a remote viewer is. And here again, it comes back to science. We give targets for practice and training that we have complete information about. We get a remote viewer to describe a place or a person or a thing or whatever, and then we take out the feedback at the end of the session, immediate feedback, and we score every single perception that they had, right or wrong, and so forth, and we develop a track record for that viewer. How good are they at colors? How good are they at shapes? How good are they at sizes? And so forth. As we develop this track record, we develop a dependability record. And that is, you give someone a target, let's say, on the surface of Mars. Well, don't have feedback right now. However, we can look at your dependability rating and look at the different perceptions you gave and know how much we can depend on you to be correct.
Very much like martial arts training, which is visible very quickly.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with the potential abuses of those that get really good at it?
Well, you really can't. When I teach my classes, I teach remote viewing to the public now. When I teach my classes, I put in some subliminals that if I catch somebody using this to hurt people, to do damage to other people, I have a little trigger word that will make them lose total interest in remote viewing and just stop doing it.
You mean it's a kind of implant into the subconscious as part of the filtering of the training?
Of my training.
Yeah, of your training.
I was trained in subliminals in the military.
Talk about what that is. Can you talk about that?
Subliminals are those things which are below your level of awareness.
Are they commands?
Oh, they can be, sure. Uh-huh. There are things in your conscious mind that you're not aware of, like what you're seeing out of the corner of your eye right now. You weren't aware of that until I mentioned it, but it was there. And I don't know if you've seen Darren Brown on the TV shows or not, but he does some amazing things with subliminals to control people to the point where they will just hand him all of their, you know, their car keys, their wallet, and everything else. And it's all subliminals. And so anyway, the only subliminals that I use when I train is the one subliminal of that trigger word that if I catch somebody hurting somebody with the remote viewing, then I will find some way to get that trigger word to them and they will just lose interest and quit. The control over what people do with this, I really don't have any control over it, and I really don't want to, because for me, that's taken away personal freedoms. But when it comes to hurting somebody with anything I teach, I have just decided I'm not going to have my life's work used to hurt people. And that's a personal thing. I tell everybody about it when we start the class. I get their okay to put in the subliminals, and I do. Because I'm not going to have my life's work used to hurt people. Simple as that.
Skip Atwater sat you down one day during your training and said to you that it's really okay to be psychic. Why did he say that to you?
Excuse me. They had done some background investigation, of course, before I ever got to the unit. I mean, you know, by the time I got to the unit, I'd probably been investigated so severely that they, you know, knew everything about me. But I had had PK events and psychic events all through my life, and had tried to suppress them. I had done everything I could. When I was very small, I was having these PK events, psychokinetic events, you know, mind over matter. Where,
right.
And I was showing off with a cute little redheaded girl one day, and, you know, my life is in many ways like Charlie Brown's. And and so she went home and was very impressed. She went home and told her father, the Pentecostal minister, and the next day he and three of his deacons met me on the sidewalk going home from school, asked for a demonstration, and the minute I gave a demonstration, they had me down on the sidewalk with their hands pressing my face into the sidewalk, screaming for the devil to come out of me, and I mean, just scared me half to death. And so from then on, I had tried to stop it. And there was this event over in Augsburg, Germany, where I was stationed in the military, where I had gotten just violently angry at another sergeant and destroyed millions of dollars worth of computers. And so the commanding general of the Intelligence and Security Command came out. He said to me, you know, he got right up in my face and scowled, and he said, "Did you kill my computers with your mind?" And I just kind of heard myself say, "Yes, sir, I did." I was standing there thinking, my great-grandchildren are going to be paying for computers. And when I said, "Yes, sir, I did," this grin went across his face, and he said, "Far effing out, have I ever got a job for you?" He wanted to take me back to D.C. to start a military unit which would destroy enemy computers and hopefully, over time, learn how to control the information in them rather than destroy them. And so we got back there to D.C., and he went before Congress to get the funding, and Congress said, "That's mind control," and so no. Congress had been caught on mind control things before, and they didn't want to have that happen again. But they said, "That's mind control," so absolutely not. And so I was there in D.C. without an assignment, and so General Stubblebine just put me into the remote viewing unit. And that was on April Fool's Day, 1984. And so I went out to this little unit out in the woods here in this old splinter-type World War II buildings. And they read me onto the project. Reading you on is where they tell you what the project is and make you sign your life away if you ever, you know, tell anybody until it's declassified and all. And so they started telling me what the unit was and what the unit did, and I thought, what a nice general to give me a, you know, an April Fool's trick like this, because, you know, the military doesn't do this. And sure enough, they did. They had a remote viewing unit, and all of a sudden, there I was in it. And so that was April Fool's Day, 84, and I stayed there the rest of my time in the military.
That's amazing. And that was 8.5 years, correct?
About 8.5 years, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Army rotates you every 3 years, no matter what. And I had become the trainer of the military unit. And so by special dispensation and all, I got to stay there about the rest of my military career.
Why did it become declassified?
Well, in D.C., there are always two answers to every question you can possibly have. And those are money and politics. The Cold War was over. People were getting let off. The slots for spies and everything else were just dwindling away and quitting their funding. And so here was this unit that was supposedly a psychic unit, and everybody's, you know, that's a four-letter word in D.C. And so the unit got disbanded. Well, in late 95, there was one of our military members who went out and started talking to the press and showing up on TV saying that all this, you know, had happened and the military was using psychics and all this other. And so the CIA had to respond in some way. And so the way they responded was they put out a letter saying, yes, there was a unit like this. They were totally ineffective, and so we got rid of them. Well, the fact is that they had done studies, and we had a higher accuracy rate than spy in the sky satellites.
That's totally mind-blowing.
It really is. We had a 72.8% accuracy rate, and you know, it's not only mind-blowing that that's the highest, but also that spy in the sky satellites aren't that accurate.
Why?
So well, because of the information has to be interpreted, and the satellite interpreters aren't that accurate.
Sounds very expensive also. It's like overkill in terms of technology expense. But when what you're doing and the teams that were trained in controlled remote viewing are doing doesn't waste as much money.
Well, that's true. In every unit, you know, you have the personnel and the equipment. And in our unit, the personnel was the equipment, so they got us for half price. But, you know, the thing is that our information went into a big pool with all the other intel sources. And things like spy in the sky satellites, they're very expensive. But, you know, you compare that to the loss of freedom by being overrun by another country, it's sort of, I think, worth the buck. So, yeah, intelligence is very expensive, but without it, we wouldn't have a country. So,
why did you name your book The Seventh Sense?
The Seventh Sense came from research that we had done and that I had done personally, realizing that you have the five senses, which are physical. And then there is another sense where you get the ambiance in the room around you. And the ambiance is a dependable sense. It's repeatable. You put 100 people, one at a time, into a cathedral, they're going to get that hushed feeling. You put them on the edge of a cliff, they're going to get, whoa, you know. And it's a repeatable sense, but there's no body part to stick it to. And what we found through the study of psychics, you know, natural psychics and working psychics, is that a large portion of the work they do is not reading your future or your past or anything. It's reading you. It's reading tells, just like poker players across the table. And it's the sense of ambiance that they are extremely good at. There's a difference between that and the seventh sense, being able to sit down at a table and sense what's going on halfway around the world. And we have found that we can develop the ambient sense to a sense that is even greater than the sense of sight. And, you know, I have always said that if I could stop teaching remote viewing and start teaching the ambient sense that we learned in the military and learned to hone in the military, to the point where, you know, if I could teach that to policemen and to soldiers out in the field, we would stop having dead cops and dead soldiers. And, I mean, it's a trainable thing. It's not psychic in any way. And yet it's extremely valuable. And anyway, the ambient sense we teach in our course, and we teach you to distinguish between reading the room around you and reading a room that's halfway around the world. Because there is a definite distinction between the ambient sense and the psychic sense, which is actually the seventh.
Really?
Yeah. And once you learn to distinguish those differences, all of a sudden you learn to tell, you know, like you see TV psychics, you learn to tell when they're actually being psychic, which is actually a very minor part of the time. They will get an impression, a psychic impression. Then they will logically start building on it and, you know, read the audience to know what to say and all that. Now, I'm not saying they're doing this on purpose, because most people, and as far as I've seen, most psychics don't know the difference between ambiance and psychic sense, between the sixth and the seventh sense.
You also talk about in your book that the brain is really trained, or our minds are trained, to name things and figure out stuff, and not necessarily trained in the faculty of describing.
Right, because all Indo-European languages are built on nouns. And, I mean, they are built around nouns. And so the fact is that a natural psychic will tend to try to get the answer. We have to try to get the description and the information that we can give to the Department of Defense or to some company or something, so that they can make decisions with information. We don't make the decisions for them. And this fact that our language is built around nouns means that as soon as you get a noun, you tend to lock yourself into an idea. So you start describing something, and you have, you know, I give you a sight, and you say there's something red, something round, something rubbery. Oh, I'll bet it's a ball. You lock yourself into the idea of a ball game or a beach ball or something like that, whatever comes to mind. And from that point on, you're not giving pure information. You're giving polluted information. You're doing what's called building castles. You start building a castle wall, and you only start adding the stuff that fits the wall. If something doesn't fit, you throw it away. And so a person, once having accepted a noun, will then start taking only those descriptors which fit that preconceived idea, and it acts as pollution, and it will actually draw a viewer off. So when a person comes up with a noun, we make them set them aside and go back to describing, because you may not have a ball. You may have a site where there's something round, something red, and something else rubbery. And so we demand descriptors, not nouns. Interestingly enough, I have some Apache Indians who are students as well. The Apache language is built around verbs. And we have to make them set their verbs aside, because they will jump to conclusions. You know, they'll say, it's walking. Oh, therefore it must be a person. And, you know, and they do the same, because the Apache language is built around verbs and not nouns. And so we have to make them set their verbs aside, because the minute they come up with a verb, like it is walking,
right,
oh, therefore it must be a person, and so they lock themselves into an idea. And so, you know, the linguistic base that we have as Indo-European people, will trap us in this actual work.
Is there a way in your training in controlled remote viewing, as it is today, to give an instruction or what you call a subliminal to the subconscious to strengthen itself to become this tuned faculty that gets stronger and stronger every time these protocols are used and becomes more and more effective at gathering data?
My son asked me that one time. He said, hey, Dad, why don't you get into my mind and give me like a subliminal thing and make me a good remote viewer? And I said, okay. And he said, what? And I said, sure, I'll do that. And he said, Dad, what are you going to put into my mind? And I said, practice, practice, practice. And practice is the only way.
By the way, I didn't mean to not practice. What I was saying is there's a lot of teaching out there about the subconscious that says it pretty much will follow whatever you tell it to do, so be careful what you tell your subconscious to do. Mine was more a pure question of not manipulating the subconscious, but having the subconscious agree to be utilized and agree to participate in this process and to tell it that it will become better as it goes along. That's what I meant.
Yeah. We have found that there doesn't seem to be any way except practice, practice, practice. And in fact, as a person learns remote viewing, they will do extremely well. And then all of a sudden, they'll start doing very poorly. What happens is, as the conscious and subconscious start talking to each other, old grudges get dredged up, and the two have to work through these things until, you know, they get them resolved, and then all of a sudden your remote viewing, you know, they start cooperating with each other again. And somewhere along the line, some other old grudge will come up, and all of a sudden your results drop to, you know, pig slop, and that gets resolved, and all of a sudden your accuracy rate and your results come back up to a higher level. And it actually works as a plateau-type learning, where a person will have a certain ability and a certain accuracy rate and can't get above it. And all of a sudden something gets resolved, and they go up to the next plateau. And so this is not a process where you, you know, just teach somebody to put the envelope to the forehead and say the answer is. This is a science, and it's a learning process just like any other learning process, just like playing the piano or tennis or whatever. It's plateau learning, and it takes practice, 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 practice.
After your classes, someone comes for a workshop at a beginner's level. When they leave you, they're still in communication with you, and they're still practicing when they go home, wherever they go, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Our classes are all 3 days long. There is no way you can learn remote viewing in 3 days. And I know a lot of other trainers then charge you, like one charges $200 for 20 hours or 20 days, whichever comes first, you know, 20 hours of consultation time. Or if you don't use it up in 20 days, then you pay again for the next 20 hours. I don't do that. I figure that people come to me to learn remote viewing. And so once they have paid for the class, then they have paid for learning. And so they have my phone number. They have my email address. We have a online email list where people can write questions and write of any problems they have. And other trained remote viewers, from beginners all the way to the ex-military, will come back and answer these questions for them. We also have it so that once you've taken a class, you can come back to that class again as many times as you want to for the rest of your life for free.
That's extraordinary. That's really the highest dedication a teacher can have with a student.
Well,
once the student's committed,
I want
right?
to learn remote viewing. and whatever it takes to get them to learn remote viewing, that's what I'm after.
Lynn, let's talk about the concept of time. This is at the core in our paradigms about the past, the present, and the future. Obviously, it's malleable. Talk about its malleability and how it's not what we think it is.
One of the things that we learned in controlled remote viewing is that time is not what you've always been told. You've always been told that it's linear and goes in one direction. Well, it is linear because every cause has an effect and every effect has a cause. And there's usually a straight line between them. But the fact is that you can go backwards in time. We have even, and don't ask me to explain this because we don't have time in this program to explain it. We have even found that you can go up and down and sideways and at angles in time. And time is extremely malleable. Now, we developed a methodology called associative remote viewing, which is different from controlled remote viewing. And associative remote viewing, what we do is we have found that the future is very changeable. And so we take a situation and make it to where the future will not change, period. So let's say that tonight is the night for the drawing of the lottery balls.
Okay.
Okay. Let's take the pick three because that's the easiest. The pick three ball is going to have one number on it. Numbers are extremely hard to remote view. However, things like sounds, smells, tastes, and all that are very easy to remote view. So we look in the database and find out what you're best at. Let's say you're best at taste, and that's your highest accuracy of anything. Okay, so I say at 7:30 tonight, there's going to be the first ball in the lottery will be drawn. And if there's a zero on it, then I will give you some chocolate at 9 o'clock tonight. If there's a 1, I'll give you some vanilla. If there's 2, I'll give you some mint. If there's 3, I'll give you some Coca-Cola or something like that. And we set up these senses that are easy to view. Okay? Now, at 9 o'clock tonight, you will be there, and I will give you a taste, which will be determined by the number on the first ball. So this morning, all I have to do is take you to 9 o'clock tonight and say, tell me what you're tasting. I taste mint. Oh, thank you very much. I know at 10 o'clock this morning that the number on the first ball is going to be a 2.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can move forward in time, bring back information, and that information can be of such a nature that you can profit by it. Once a year, we have a class in ARV, and at the end of the class, the last afternoon, we go up to the Indian casinos up on the reservation. And, I mean, it's common knowledge that when you go to an Indian casino, you're just supporting the Indians. You're not going to win. You're not coming back. so far, we have had one student break even, and everyone else has won money, and nobody has lost. And what we simply do is we say, okay, we go to the roulette wheel. If there's if the ball is going to land in a black spot, I'll take a sip of my coffee. If it's going to land in a red spot, I'll take a sip of my Coke. I've got a candy bar in my pocket. If it's going to land in a green spot, I'll take a bite of the candy bar. And so you sit there at the edge of the roulette wheel and you say to yourself, because you have learned to move through time through training and all, okay, move to the moment of my feedback. What am I tasting? Candy. Oh, thank you very much. I bet on the green.
Wow, I'm coming to your class.
Well, the amazing thing is that it works. It actually works. And, it's
I'm in.
A lot of training. takes a lot of practice. This is not something that you learn overnight. We teach the ARV to our regular CRV clients just as a familiarization, and everybody immediately wants to go out that evening and bet on the pick six lottery, which has actually 12 digits to it, you know, because there are six balls, two digits on each, and they want to go out and win millions of dollars. And guess what? Hasn't happened yet.
Lynn, this really makes me wonder, and I'm sure listeners are wondering, if you're able to go in and out and move through time, what does that indicate to us about our free will? What does that mean then? What are we in? Are we in a matrix, literally?
Well, I kind of think we are. However, you know, the past seems to be more fixed than the future. There do seem to be ways that we can influence the past and hopefully even change the past. But the future is still open. And one of the analogies that we use is that you're a bug on the pond of time, and you see another bug across the pond, and it's sitting there, and you think that would make a good meal, and it's sitting there beside this big rock. So you go skittering across. You decide the direction you're going in time, and you skitter across the pond of time, and it sets up a wake in front of you, and that wake may scare away that other bug, but it can't scare away the rock. There are rocks in the pond of time, and there are bugs on the pond of time, and the trouble is, you know, that we have a hard time telling the difference. There are some things in time that are going to happen no matter what.
Why?
I don't know. Sort of the analogy I like best is that life is like playing chess with God, and, you know, you can pull off some really smart moves, and you can capture some men, and you can do your best. But in the end, he's going to win the game.
How is this translated into your relationship with God or a divine creator?
I have a very close relationship with God. And some of the remote viewing targets that I've gotten in the past, and even in the military, have brought me even into a closer relationship with God. I have learned in very real terms the difference between churchianity and Christianity. And
That's a great distinction.
That's a really great distinction. It's a distinction that most people don't make. But relationship I have, well, 3 weeks ago, I got bitten by a rattlesnake. And I didn't go to a doctor, didn't go to the emergency ward or anything. Now, I don't recommend this to everybody. You know, I just sort of sucked it up and lived with it. Well, one of my friends, in fact, one of the medicine men up on the Indian reservation, he said, well, you could have died. And I said, no, when God wants me to die, I die. When some rattlesnake wants me out of his, you know, out of his imaginary territory, I'm not going to die for that, you know. And I said, many, many things in life are determined simply by who you put in charge of your life. And as for me, I put God in charge.
Very, very interesting. Have you ever been accused of being of the devil?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Not only of the devil, but also of the government and, you know, of the Illuminati and of the who knows what. Yeah, I still get like one or two death threats a month.
Seriously?
Because people think that, you know, there are some people with very loose touch to reality. And they think that the government is in their mind and eating away at their brain and everything. And all of a sudden, they find me on the internet, and I was the government remote viewer and the trainer. And they all of a sudden have a name to put to their fears. And, I get death threats still, you know.
Does it ever just become another thing?
Oh, yeah. I took a couple of them to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist looked them over, and he said, listen, the ones that you have to fear are the ones that don't threaten, because you never know they're coming. And he said the ones that do threaten, they vent their anger. That gives them relief from their fears, and you know, they're the ones you don't have to worry about.
There are some remote viewers that have remote viewed people's passings, their deaths.
Yeah, yeah.
Why? Why are they doing that?
One of the teachers that's out there gives his students has them remote view the moment of their death, which I think is pretty
traumatic.
It's a crappy thing to do. You know, I would never do that. But that same teacher, when we were both in the military, he found out that I would not view death, that I just shied away from it. And so he started giving me people targets, which I'm good at, and he would move me forward through time. Well, he would select these people who were dying in all these different situations, and he would move me through the moment of their death on. I was raised Baptist in East Texas, and you go to heaven or you go to hell, and that's it. And what I found out from these sessions was that there are those who go to what I would call hell, and a tenth of a second after they move there, I would be thrown out of that session, and I would have nightmares for a month. There are other people who go to what I would call heaven, and I would, you know, just totally affect my life positively and all that, as from the experience. There are also people who tend to reincarnate and come back as around like a 12-year-old kid, not as a baby, but a 12-year-old kid. And there are others who just quit existing. And so what I learned from it is that maybe the atheists are correct. Maybe the Baptists are correct. Maybe, you know, the reincarnationists are correct and all that. I never found any kind of correlation between the way the person lived and what happened to them after, you know, they went through the death experience.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. I just know that, you know, if there's a chance to go to hell, I sure don't want to do it.
I think it's really refreshing that you say when you don't know, because usually when you have a high degree of competency in a number of areas or in anything, people are very reluctant to say, you know, I don't know that. I have no idea.
Yeah, but, you know, the fact is that we're still in kindergarten here.
Indeed.
I mean, we have so much to learn about the human mind, the human psyche, the way it works, and our connection to the, I guess you would say, the great unknown, the collective consciousness or whatever. There's so much yet to learn that I think it's irresponsible to just make up an answer when you don't know the answer. I think it's very responsible to delineate exactly what you don't know.
What do you think about the near-death experiences that people have shared around the earth? Their physical body went into a state of death, but their consciousness and their spirit returned to their body to continue their life.
Been there once. I was in a coma from viral encephalitis from the measles that had gotten into my spinal column. And the doctor had said, you know, that I would not live through the night. And I had one of these experiences. And I think they're real. I know mine was.
Can you describe it to us? It's just if you'd like to share it, if it's too private, that's fine.
Well, it's pretty private.
Okay.
It's pretty private.
Okay. We'll do.
Not anything embarrassing or anything, but it's just a very long story that of what happened to me during that experience. But it was wonderful. I don't think I'm going to go to hell, you know, if that's an indicator.
Ingo Swann, who is considered the father of remote viewing, at least one of them, said something about how remote viewing is a sidelined human faculty.
Yeah.
Sidelined by skeptics, sidelined by people of all backgrounds.
By churchianity, and amazingly, not by Christianity, but by churchianity.
When you say churchianity, are you more referring to the dogma?
The dogma.
Okay.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Part of it, I think, is necessary. Our civilization lives and functions because there are secrets. Also, I think at a very early age, you get a young baby in a crib, and the parents are fighting and yelling and screaming at each other. The baby has to develop a psychic wall to keep that anger out. They can't keep the noise out. They still scream and all that. But the anger and the feelings and all that, they have to protect themselves from that. And I think even in the crib, we start developing protection from our psychic sense.
So that we don't let everything in.
Yeah. Okay. Can you imagine going to a restaurant and all of a sudden having all of the psyches of everybody in the restaurant just pounding in on you? You couldn't eat your meal. You'd have to leave.
The future of the United States of America, the future of the planet, this thing about 2012, which reminds me of a Y2K gone wild cosmic.
Oh, moment. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Talk a little bit about what you can share, about what you've looked at, what you can say about 2012, if you've looked, and anything else after that that you could share with us in a way that is meaningful to you?
Yeah, the things that I have looked at, such as leading up to 212 and all that, not really rosy. The economy is being destroyed, and especially in the United States, and this has to happen for certain things to come about. But 212, I think, will be an absolute turning point, and that it will happen without anybody really knowing it except those who are in the know. The public will just, you know, sort of wake up the next morning on the 22nd of December and say, ha ha, it never happened, and go on with their lives. The things that have to happen is a thinning out of the population. That's going to take place. And
what does that mean?
It's going to mean a lot of people dying, and not in very pleasant ways. There are some hard times ahead for us. It means a good probably third to a half of our population dying off or not being replaced, you know, by new births and so forth. The end result, I think, is going to be an agrarian society, or this is what I get from the remote viewing I've done, will be an agrarian society that is very self-sufficient, has the result of all of the scientific developments, but none of the pressure of population out of control, none of the pressure of economic hardships and all that. And so I think it's going to be a very good time afterwards, but there's going to be some very hard times getting there.
You're actually sensing, seeing, remote viewing a depopulation event. I don't know how else to articulate it.
Yeah, a series of events, yeah. Mm-hmm. And my whole description there, was that vague enough for you?
Well, when you remote viewed this, how did you feel?
I felt that it was going to be unfortunate, but that in order for basically humanity to survive, that it had to happen. I felt it was unfortunate.
And you're not talking necessarily about our perception of war, that it happens only through a war.
I think we've learned the hard way that war is not the way to get things done, and that those who are in the power to do it have learned that war is not the best way and that they're finding better ways now.
Boy, that's really scary, and it's sad, and it's unfortunate beyond comprehension.
Well, yeah, you know, and, you know, one way to do it, make seeds so they can't reproduce.
It's already being done by Monsanto.
It's already being done. All of these things that are, you know, I say it will happen by 2012, December the 21st.
Right.
These things are already happening.
Yeah, I know.
It will just come to a head on that date, and that date will be the day when there's no return. There's no way to tip it back and save ourselves from it.
I guess if you get control of the food supply at the seed level, you file patents on the molecular structure of seeds, you file patents on animals, you control the entire food population of the planet.
Well, yeah, and, you know, if you develop a virus that will keep seeds from reproducing, you know, viruses mutate. And so what else will it keep from reproducing, you know? And how easy would it be at that point to make it mutate in the way you want it to? So anyway, you know, there. I think war is sort of outdated. It's been proven not to work all that well.
This is really hard to hear.
To view too. Some of the things that I've viewed, I have come out of the sessions just horrified, and had to, you know, talk to myself afterwards to say, hey, remember what you viewed last time further on in the future, and this is how it's going to, and, you know, I have had to logically talk my way back from it, from the horror of some of the things that are going to happen.
Do you think we'll ever get our seeds back? There are still seeds you can buy that they haven't touched.
Yeah. I think they'll go totally black market, but yeah.
They're even trying to stop farmers from growing fresh fruits and vegetables, from growing your own gardens even. That's how serious it is.
Yeah. Well, here in New Mexico, they are trying to come out with a law that says if you put up solar panels, Power Company of New Mexico, PNM, is a privately owned company, and that if you put up power panels, any electricity that you generate yourself, you have to pay PNM for that electricity, even though you generated it yourself. And the, you know, people that are pushing totally ridiculous and inhumane laws through, they have the power. No pun intended. Yeah.
You don't see in your viewing that these people are ever out of power?
Yeah, I do. When the need for power and all that tends to go away, you know, it will go away. When human values become more valuable than the power, then I think that will become outmoted too. It'll probably come back at some future time, but there won't be a need for it.
What do you think about where we're at with regard to space technology, going into space, concern about weaponizing space? Are we having space wars? Are we even able at that point to still go out into space?
Oh, yeah. I don't see any space wars as such, but I do see, you know, alien contact. And I do, well, back in, 96 or somewhere around there, we did a project for a moon exploration company. They were wanting to find out how to build a temporary moon base that would then let them have quarters for their people so that they could build a more permanent moon base. What we did was we went into the future, looked at the temporary moon base and described it, and came back and they said, oh, great, that's the biggest idea we've seen. What we found was that you take some mylar plastic that's kind of silverized so that it, you know, filters out some of the harmful rays, stretch it over a small crater, and fill the crater with 16 pounds of pressure. That's about half of what you get in a bicycle tire. And that's also pressure at sea level. And people can live in there. Well, if a small meteorite punches through that plastic sheeting, all you do is go up, put some duct tape over it, and it's sealed. Nothing is broken, nothing is shattered and all that. And so the Moon Exploration Company was just totally ecstatic over it, and in fact have recently come out with a thing that they, same company, that they discovered where they can make a temporary moon base by putting a sheet of plastic over a crater and using duct tape to seal the holes.
Wow.
And so, you know, there are resources on the moon, and we'll be able to get those resources. And I think it's going to take quite a long time to get anything in space where we're so territorial that there would be wars over it. I mean, right now, in order to get into space, we have to be helpful to each other.
Let's talk about alien contact. Do you think there will be in our lifetime, Lynn?
I know there already has been. But as far as public awareness of alien contact, yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. How far out do you think it is?
Probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 more years.
Do you want to share about how you know that there are alien beings or civilizations here? Do you want to say something about that?
Do I want to? Yes.
Okay.
But I won't. let's say I'd better not.
Okay.
Before I went into the military, into the remote viewing unit, I was a programmer who had clearances just, you know, that nobody else had. And the military was just getting into desktop computers. And there are all these black projects that they couldn't get programmers for in order to do the specialty work they did. And so I got called around, sent around to all these black projects, and would get, you know, read onto a project in order to develop the computer programming for them. And I'll tell you, it got to the point where I would go to one of these black projects and I would say, look, don't tell me anything that I don't want to know, okay? I'm here to write a program. Only tell me what you need for the program. And the military and the government are into some really, really strange stuff. And I was exposed to a lot of stuff that I still won't talk about no matter what.
Did it scare you?
Some of it did, yeah. And some of it I thought was just the neatest toys I'd ever seen in my whole life. And they're into some good stuff, some really good stuff that's beneficial to mankind. And they're into some stuff that I thought was totally horrible. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenges you have had in your training with remote viewing in the unit and also afterwards with your family. In what you can share, the challenges of what someone at your level of competency in this particular area has gone through?
Well, I think the challenges for me personally were the same that happened with anybody learning remote viewing, and that is that you have to give up probably about 90% of your old paradigms because you learn that what you've learned all the way through life and have depended on and even built your life on may not be true. And so you have to give up paradigms. There are a lot of paradigm changes, and that is always sort of a chaotic and many times a very hard time. But as you grow as a person, it's definitely worth it. But, you may have some changes that are fairly drastic and fairly chaotic to you. When people come for training, we have one paragraph in the training agreement that says that changes will happen to you and may not happen to those around you. And so we give the example of, let's say you're a hardened alcoholic, and because you get in touch with yourself and you become a new person, you don't need the alcohol anymore. However, Now your wife doesn't have a drinking partner, and she's an alcoholic too. She's going to go find another drinking partner, and I want people to understand that the divorce will not be our fault. Okay. And so, you know, as your life changes, it's going to affect your family and everything else. I think you may be referring to the point in my book where I was driving home one Friday afternoon. I had been mentally accessing a foreign leader that day at work, and there was something that kept nagging at me and nagging at me. Well, I finally just dismissed it, got off work, was headed home, and I live 70 miles from the house. You know, I live 70 miles from work, and so I had a long drive home, and I was planning what I would do that weekend, and I said, well, let's see, I'm going to, you know, mow the lawn, going to wash the car, going to do this other stuff, and going to kill my wife and do some other stuff, and I backed up, and I said, wait a minute, what? And what had been nagging at me from accessing that foreign leader was the fact that he was going to kill his wife that weekend. And it turned up later as a thought that I had for my plans on the way home. Of course, I would not have done it. But that weekend, that foreign leader did kill his wife.
Is that classified?
His name, yeah. As to who it is, yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow.
But,
wow.
His wife died under extremely mysterious circumstances, and everybody knew that he had killed her. But anyway, you know, it can affect your family, either directly or indirectly. And we teach detoxification, by the way, to get you out of another person's mind if you happen to get mental access. But, you know, the changes in your life will naturally affect your family.
Did you brief your wife as to what could happen based on how you were briefed so she was prepared for some of it?
Well, actually, a little thing happened over in Augsburg, Germany. Two of the officers came, and they said they took the personal responsibility. They said, "Look, the secrecy of what's going on in our unit is causing divorces and all that among our personnel," and so they read me on to the project while Linda was sitting there, and so she heard the entire thing. And they, you know, they asked her, what do you think about this? And she was all for it. And so she actually knew ahead of time what I would be getting into.
That's awesome. I think that's great.
It really is. They were taking their, you know, their careers. They were putting their careers in jeopardy by doing that. But they were just tired of people in the unit changing and that causing divorces, you know, on the home front.
When there was no need to, if you had adequate upfront disclosure about what they can
no,
expect.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, they were also afraid of the whole word psychic. When actually, we're getting back to this, this is a science. I mean, you sit down, you go through it in a scientific methodology. It doesn't take a psychic to do it. And so along that respect, there was no real reason to classify this at all. Never has been, or in my mind anyway.
Can you share with us some of your insights about going into Saddam Hussein's mind?
Yeah, this was a thing that we did to get his plans and intentions. And, you know, the man didn't stand a chance. We knew what he was going to do at least a day before he did it. And one of the big things that we realized very quickly in doing this set us up for doing it for other leaders too. And that is that if Saddam Hussein, who was very crazy, if he planned to do something, that didn't mean he was going to do it. And so we... You know, because by the next day he may radically change his mind. And so we learned over a long period of time to distinguish between plans that are going to be carried out and plans that are just, you know, sitting around, why I ought to do such and such.
He thought he was on a mission from God, didn't he?
He really did. He thought that God wanted him to rule the world, and he was very confused as to why other people didn't see that. And so when he killed off people, personally or through his troops or whatever, basically what he was doing in his mind was he was clearing the way for God's purpose. And, you know, he was always really confused about why he was such a good guy and nobody could understand that.
Didn't you share with me that he had plans to run the world and to somehow launch some type of nuclear so that he was in control of the Arab world? Talk about that.
Well, there was one session that I did where there is a thing called a Phase 7 where I won't go into the explanation of it. But anyway, the information that came up was, you're not going to believe what comes next. And that came up right in the middle of my session. So I went on, you know, I wrote it down. You have to report everything. And what came next, I could not believe that he had stolen a missile, a U.S. missile, was going to lob it into Mecca on the, you know, during the Feast of Ramadan, and kill off all of the people going to the Hajj and also all of the other Arab leaders, leaving him as the leader of the Muslim world to bring a holy jihad against the non-Muslim world. The fact is, and this wasn't really told to the U.S. or anybody else, but at that time, he could have won. And I passed that session on up to my director, and he said, oh, I don't believe any Arab would do this, but maybe I'd better pass it on up just in case. And it went on all the way up the chain of command, and sure enough, they investigated, and he had an American missile pointed right at Mecca and waiting for the Feast of Ramadan. And the fact is that if it hadn't been for that one session, I'm fairly well convinced that right now either you and I would be Muslim or dead, and those would be our only two choices.
Why?
Because they would have won.
From one missile?
Oh, no, from the war. From the war that resulted.
Oh, okay.
That one missile would have started a war between the Muslims and the non-Muslims, and at that time, especially, the Muslims would have won.
Hmm. You also did work inside the Lockerbie explosion in the sky when the plane went down with David Morehouse, didn't you?
Yeah, that was a particularly hard one, yeah.
Can you share something about that?
Well, the people on the plane, you know, were dead. And basically it was one of those that was such a surprise that they had no idea what was going on, and their spirits were basically wandering back and forth around the plane trying to figure out what happened and so forth. And so Dave Morehouse and I and I think it was Mel Riley went in and just sort of explained and got them started on their way to an afterlife. But it was a particularly bad thing. What we were looking for was the cause of the explosion. And I think it was Dave Morehouse that found the actual cause of the explosion. And when the investigators on the site opened or found the remnants of the suitcase, they figured that Dave, you know, it proved that Dave was right. He got his feedback on that.
But didn't that explode in the air? Did all these people die, like, in the air or not till they hit the ground?
No, it exploded in the air, and most of them died in the air, but a few rode the plane all the way down to the ground and were just in horror, you know, and actually died when the plane hit.
God. How terrible. That must have been a terrible one to view.
Oh, it was. We have viewed some pretty terrible things. When I have students here, I try to impress on them that this is not a toy. This is the real thing, and that you want to be very careful what you are given to view, because, you know, humanity is not a nice race. They can do some awfully inhumane things to other humans and animals and so forth. And so you have to be very trustful that the person who's tasking you is not going to task you with some of these things before you're trained and ready to receive them.
I would think that would be essential to have the stewardship be clean and pure.
Absolutely. And I don't know how many times I have seen psychic groups, well-meaning and often very talented, who would get together and there would be a headline of some missing child, and they'll get together and decide, you know, try to psychically find out what happened to the child and all this. And it takes many of the better psychics through the experience of getting molested, murdered, dismembered, spread across acres of land and so on. And once they have that experience, they may, over time, get away from the emotion of it, but they never get away from the memory. And I think the well-meaning projects that many psychic groups have has ruined more psychics than probably anything else. You have to be trained to go through these things. What if you took a fledgling cop his first day on the force and took him to the worst, most gross murder? You know, you'd lose a cop.
Absolutely.
Well, it's the same thing with the psychic.
The book Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Yeah, Betty Edwards.
Betty Edwards has this book that's been out a long time that has really helped prepare and be part of the training of remote viewing, one part of it, the ideogram. Can you talk about her, the book, and how it relates to the ideogram in the sessions?
Yeah, she is an artist, and she wrote a book on drawing, how to draw on the right side of the brain, and that is using your subconscious mind as the sort of as the eye that you're going to view a picture with, so that you can draw it more accurately, and so that you can draw it with feeling and with the intuitiveness that an artist really needs to have. And this book actually teaches you physical moves and physical ways to get in touch with your own subconscious mind. As a result, that became the only mandatory reading that we had in the military unit. Everybody who came in had to go through the book and go through the workbook and do all of the exercises and everything. And it's amazing how working through that book and learning how to draw pictures, you set up a line of communications with your own subconscious mind, you become more creative, you become more intuitive. And listen, that book I would recommend to anyone and everyone. It is a fantastic book. And, you know, the fact that it sets up that line of communications between your conscious and subconscious mind, that was not lost on us, because that's what we were training people to do.
That's great. And this has been around a long time. Isn't that funny how a book can be around for a long time? It could be seminal, critical to a certain group, and then all of a sudden you find out it's way more important than anybody ever knew.
Oh, yeah.
And that it's something that should be almost like required reading. It's that profound and that helpful.
It is. It is a totally profound book. And, you know, along that line, simple things. We would, whenever a person did something completely right, followed the protocols completely right and all that, we had a reward system that was just amazingly effective. We would have him eat some M&Ms.
With a little corn syrup in them, right on. Go ahead.
Yeah, but chocolate is a reward to the brain. And so, you know, when they did everything correctly, hey, hand them an M&M. And it reinforces the behavior, and it was a great training tool. In my book, I was putting, you know, I had put a whole page or two about the military use of M&Ms, and of course, they cut out 150 pages out of my book before they published it, and almost all of that was about the military use, the military practice, and military protocols and everything else. And that part got cut out. But simple things like giving a person an M&M as a reward for doing things correctly, it really works.
Wow. M&M's has a whole new place. If they got out the corn syrup, we may start using it more.
That's right.
I have three more questions, and I really appreciate your time. I know we're coming to the end of this first interview together, and I so appreciate you being with us. One is, have you ever looked into the future and asked the question, are we going to be chipped as human population?
Chipped?
Microchipped.
Oh, microchipped. No, I haven't. I've never been tasked to do that, and I haven't done it myself. But I think there's probably going to be a time when that becomes a real fashionable thing to do. I don't really see it as something that's going to be forced. You know, this is all logic. This is not remote view.
Right.
I think it's going to become fashionable for a while and then probably die away.
Because I know it's in the Bible and there's a concern that this was written about long ago, and all of this has been in a trillion-dollar industry where all kinds of things are chipped now, clothes are chipped and papers chipped, and it's all the barcode. So I just wondered.
It's all barcode, and it's all sales, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to chip your child because that's the way you love your child and protect your child and all that, you know. It's spin doctors, yeah.
You had a ninja come to you for training.
Yeah.
You and I spoke a little bit about this, and I just think it's so fascinating. I was wondering if you could share from having trained a ninja, you training a ninja.
Yeah.
What that was like, what you learned from the ninja.
Oh, well, I learned a tremendous amount from the ninja, probably more than he learned from me. But he came, they have a thing in ninja training called Sake no Jutsu, which is complete awareness of everything in 360 degrees around you and within striking distance of a sword. And in order to become a seventh level black belt, they have to kneel in a hallway for, you know, throughout an entire day, busy hallway. And at some time during the day, one of the higher level masters will come up and swing a sword at them. And it's a real sword. It's sharp. They either duck or they wind up in the hospital or the morgue or whatever. And this is over in Japan. And so he came and he said, the Sake no Jutsu is within striking distance of a sword, but people have guns now. You know,
right.
That's becoming a problem for the ninjas. And so anyway, he wanted to learn this ambiance exercise. Well, he took the remote viewing course just to learn the ambiance exercise. But I got a call a good 6 months after he finished the class, and he said, the neatest thing happened last night. My wife and I were going to a movie, and we had to park about three blocks away because the traffic and all. And after the movie, the streets were empty. We were walking back to the car, and he said, about a block and a half away, I realized that there were some guys waiting around the corner waiting to jump out and mug us. So he said, we walked on, and sure enough, they jumped out and mugged us, you know, and tried to mug us. And I said, well, are you all right? He said, I'm an eighth level ninja. He said, of course I'm all right. They're in the hospital. But he said, you don't understand why I'm calling. I knew it a block and a half away.
Wow.
And, I mean, he was just bowled over that the ambiance exercise had let him extend this Sake no Jutsu, which has been the practice for centuries and centuries and has not been really improved on, to where he could, you know, extend that out to even a block and a half away.
Amazing. Why do you think it is today there are still ninjas?
Well, obviously, there's probably a need for them, but obviously it's also a martial art, and there are people interested in martial arts.
You think they could ever train people here in this country?
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of ninjas here.
Really?
In fact, this guy is from the U.S. He did all of his training and everything else in Japan, but then he moved to the U.S. He's here, yeah.
Wow. Boy, would I love to interview him.
Yeah, I doubt you'll get the chance.
That'd be fabulous. We'd have to call him a fake name.
Yeah, and, you know, if you interview him, don't do it in person. You may not live through it.
Aren't they trained to be peaceful until they need not to be?
Extremely.
Yeah. So I wouldn't worry.
No. I was walking down a hallway right behind him one time, and I thought, I wonder if I could reach out and tap him on the back before he knew it. And without even turning around or breaking his stride or anything, he looked over his shoulder and said, "Don't even think about it," and just kept on walking.
Oh, my God. That's the real deal.
Oh, it really is, yeah.
And lastly, let's talk about investments. People are going to want to take your class for all kinds of things, to be able to access data and information, to tap into the future, to deal with things that have happened in the past, to locate things. They're also going to take it to become better investors.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, to be able to be more prosperous and more effective at making money.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as we have gotten the word out that this is not just another psychic setup, that this is actually a science that anyone can do, we have had probably the most striking results from realtors who used to show 10 houses and hope to sell one, and now they show 3 houses and make a sale on a regular basis. They're making good money at it, and it's turned their careers around. Investors, business people, archaeologists, like I was saying earlier, moon exploration, space exploration people, police. We have trained an awful lot of police, drug agents, you name it. And, you know, gamblers. People come and they're professional gamblers, and they want to learn how to read people better. They want to learn how to read the roulette wheel better, and so on. And we've had a lot of success. The thing is, we are strictly real-world applications.
Yes.
We train with real-world things so that we can give immediate feedback. We train you for business. We train you for work with the police. We train you for finding missing kids. We train you for real-world things. What Melchizedek on the planet Scooby-Doo says about the way we should work our environment, we have nothing to do with that. We're that may be valuable information, and that may be good and real information that psychics get. But as a controlled remote viewer, it was born in the need to tell exactly what's going on in the battlefield and what will go on, exactly what's going on in the planners, in the politics of other countries and so on. And it was born in a practical, hard, real-world environment. And that's the way we keep it. I always tell people, you know, if this doesn't pay for itself, then, you know, we're doing something wrong. Because, you know, you should be able to go back to your business, start making correct decisions every time, business decisions. You should go back to your business and know which customers are going to be good customers, which aren't, what projects, what plans are good and will have a future and what won't. And so it's all hard, real-world applications, and that's what we teach.
I love it. But you also, as the Executive Director of Problems, Solutions, and Innovations, also called PSI, you also can be tasked yourself, correct?
Yeah. These days, I don't have a lot of time. And so right now, in fact, this morning, I got a request in to do some treasure hunting work And we've had great success with that, but I just don't have the time. And so I'm going to pass that on to some of the viewers who have the track record of doing a good job at it.
Don't you think one of the key things to task is where to buy land so that you can grow your own food and use your own seeds and set up your own shop, given what's coming into the future?
Well, yes, I do. But the at this point, the people who have the money to buy that land are few and far between, and the economy is getting worse. And most of the land, well, I know we live out here in the desert, and we're growing things extremely well through organic gardening. But, I mean, this is the land you can buy, and unless you really know what to do, you're going to raise cactus, and that's it.
Got it. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on as a guest, Lynn. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with, learning from, and listening to Lynn Buchanan, the author of Seventh Sense, The Secrets of Remote Viewing, as told by a psychic spy for the U.S. military. He is also the executive director of Problem Solutions Innovations, also called PSI. You can reach Lynn by going to crviewer.com, controlledremoteviewer.com. Thank you so much, and we hope that you will come back and be a guest on the show at another time, and maybe we'll have a few guests with you on the show at that time. Thanks again,
Lynn.
That's
great. Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure.